Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Does noble sacrifice have the power to change the world? And is there a point at which self-deprivation actually interferes with one's ability to serve others in need? When Mary Johnson was in high school, she stumbled upon the iconic 1975 Time magazine cover that declared Mother Teresa a living saint. Entranced by the story of this woman who had given up so much to relieve the suffering of the world's poor, Johnson came to believe that she, too, had been called by God to serve. And a year and a half later, she left her freshman year at UT to join Mother Teresa's Order of Catholic Sisters, the Missionaries of Charity. Johnson's memoir of her 20 years with the group, including multiple interactions with its beloved founder, is called An Unquenchable Thirst, Following Mother Teresa in Search of Love, Service, and an Authentic Life. Mary, welcome to Think.
It's great to be here.
What was it at the age of, 17, about Mother Teresa's story that appealed to you?
Well, when I saw that cover of Time magazine, as you said, in the library at my high school, I just took it. I don't know. There was something in the expression on her face. And then I started reading it, and she was helping those whom no one else was helping, the lepers, the people who are dying on the streets of Calcutta, abandoned children, babies who she found in dustbins. It was like she was doing something significant. She was putting love into action. And it, she just drew me by the story of the wonderful works that she was doing and the way that she expressed that this was her love for God in action.
Hmm. And you had done well in school. You had friends. But as a teenager, you never felt as if you quite fit in with the people around you. So do you think there was an element of your commitment to a religious life that sort of tried to embrace those differences between yourself and people around you?
I think that my experience of being sort of an outsider definitely made me more empathetic to people who were on the margins. As you said, I moved from Michigan, where I was born, to Texas when I was 12. And somehow I think that culture shock never quite went away. It was hard for me to get used to Texas. Eventually I came to love Texas, but it took a while, mm-hmm. and I didn't quite fit in the beginning.
Now, your parents begged you to wait until at least you had finished college. Why did you want to go right away?
I think I had that kind of certainty that only a teenager has, where you know that what you're doing is right, mm-hmm. and it's the best thing, and nobody can really convince you otherwise. It was like a fire burning in my heart, and I just knew that I had to do it.
We should say here that although you were a very devout Catholic and passionate about serving other people, you were not someone who easily submitted blindly to authority. Did you realize before you joined the order just how few decisions you would be making for yourself in the years to come?
I had no idea that every moment of my day would be scheduled from the time I got up at 4:40 in the morning until I went to bed at 10 o'clock at night, mm-hmm. that we would have 1 hour of free time a week, and that very often we wouldn't even really get that. I had no idea that I would be sent places to work without ever being asked what sort of work I would like. I knew, obviously, that I was entering a group where I would vow obedience. I knew that I wouldn't be in charge of the major decisions. But I hadn't anticipated at all the degree to which that would be true.
Yeah, give us the schedule of a typical day. And you have it reproduced exactly in the book. Just give us a sense of what a day was like.
Well, we got up at 4:40. We were all sleeping in the same dormitory on the beds just a few inches from each other. So when that bell rang in the morning, we all jumped out of bed and said a prayer right at the side of the bed. We got up, we got dressed, we were in the chapel by 5 o'clock. We had morning prayer for an hour. We had some housework. We washed our clothes. We went back for Mass. We had breakfast. And by 8 o'clock, we were out of the house doing whatever sort of apostolic work we'd been assigned, whether it was working at a soup kitchen or at a shelter or taking care of the homeless. We'd do that until lunchtime. We'd come back, have lunch together, have prayer together. We got half hour of sleep in the middle of the afternoon, which was really good. And then we would get up and have tea very quickly. We'd have more work. We'd have spiritual reading. We'd have time for prayer. All told, during the day, we had 4 hours of common prayer and more than 8 hours of work. And we usually had dinner at 7:30 in the evening and had been working pretty steadily up, you know, until then. And we would be in bed usually. We were supposed to be in bed by 10, but I often didn't make that. I had responsibilities, especially, you know, the last half of my time in the Sisters that kept me up way past that. But it was really a very packed day.
Yeah, it strikes me as not only incredibly busy and with no time for yourself, but really there was no sort of private time for you to just think on your own.
I think that was probably one of the most difficult things. Not only was there no private time, but there was no private space.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, we slept in these common dormitories. When we prayed in the chapel, we would line up and we knelt on the floor. We didn't have pews like you would have in a normal church. We just had a carpet on the floor, and we would kneel on that, everyone very close to each other and always all together. We would take all our meals at a table where very often we were crowded kind of elbow to elbow, especially in some of the bigger communities, because the Sisters really did take seriously their vow of poverty, sharing the life of the poor, and the poor very often have no privacy. And in the beginning, that was very appealing for me because it was something very radical. It was something I wanted to do, something where I could really give of myself and feel like I was doing something different with my life. But as time went on, you know, the inability to have this space for oneself or time for oneself really was very difficult for me.
And on the other side of that, you had no time and space for yourself, and yet it seems to have been an exceptionally lonely time, not least because you were discouraged from having really friendships of any kind. Touching as simple as, you know, giving somebody a pat on the shoulder was not allowed.
Yes, when my parents came, they came for my first profession of vows in Rome, which was 3 years after I had joined, and we met actually by chance in St. Peter's Square. And they came to me, and they hugged me, and I was all of a sudden very confused because I didn't know, was I allowed to hug back? I became very wooden there. It was the first time anyone had tried to hug me in 3 years. We weren't allowed any sort of touch, and it was a rather lonely life because we were not supposed to get close to any human being in the sense of, you know, having a friendship with someone more than we had with anyone else. We were supposed to relate to all the Sisters in the same way. We were supposed to keep our distance from the people with whom we worked, any people who shared work with us. We were always to be cheerful. That was one of the attitudes of the Missionaries of Charity, to be cheerful at all times, even with your Sisters, which meant that when you had some difficulty or something, you know, those events, things that bring people together, we were never really allowed to express that difficulty or the sadness, or we were always to be cheerful. So no one ever really got to know another person really as we were.
That sounds incredibly hard to be cheerful at all times, and it sounds like nobody was really very happy underneath that cheer.
Well, people were happy sometimes, of course, you know, and I definitely had moments of happiness when I was with the Sisters. There's a sense of purpose. There is a sense of community. There's a certain sense of camaraderie also, especially, I think, during the times when the Sisters were preparing for vows. We would have these years of formation where you would gather with the same group of people over and over, the same group of Sisters who were going through the same thing as you at the same time. And you could get, you know, a sense of camaraderie that could bring happiness. And some of the work with the poor also was very rewarding. And when you brought joy into other people's lives, that touched your heart as well.
Mm-hmm.
But so I don't think it's accurate to say that there were no moments of happiness. Certainly there were, and certainly extended periods where things went well. I think there, you know, that there's a sense of giving yourself when you're making these sacrifices to a greater cause that can be can bring a very sort of deep sense of joy, but it's hard to sustain that if you are not also at the same time nurtured, if you don't have time to yourself, especially because the demands of working with the poor are very great. It's not an easy job.
Yeah.
And you need some time for recovery. You need to have friends. You need to have people with whom you can share things. Never to have a vacation in 20 years. It's just difficult.
You do take pains in the book, and we should do that here, to point out the fact that not all orders of religious sisters are the same. They don't
Absolutely.
All have the same rules and
Absolutely.
Regulations. So people may remember the nuns from their Catholic school growing up that may have had a very different set of rules.
Absolutely. Each different group of nuns has very different rules. And I think the Missionaries of Charity, the group to which I belonged, had far more rules than most American groups of nuns. There's just no question about that.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps more than most groups of nuns all over the world. Initially, that's one of the draws, in the sense that you know you're giving something special. But the other groups of nuns... Yes, lived very different lives. Nuns, on the whole, normally have a more relaxed life than the one I'm presenting here and are allowed to have friends of various sorts. All nuns take a vow of chastity, so those sorts of relationships, intimate sexual relationships, are restricted. Obviously, that's not what you're supposed to do, even though that also can prove very difficult, and it did prove difficult for me. But I definitely would say that most nuns allow and encourage friendship in a way that the Missionaries of Charity didn't.
Talk about this for a minute. You had really idolized Mother Teresa, and she was the inspiration for you joining the order, and you had gone to see her speak in the past. But talk about, before you knew her better in years later, the first time you actually were in her presence and got to speak with her. What do you remember about that day?
Well, the first time that I was in Mother's presence, really, was when she arrived in the South Bronx in New York, and she just came for a visit with the sisters, and it was before the Nobel Peace Prize. The kind of the relationships that the sisters had with Mother Teresa can kind of be divided into pre-Nobel Prize and post-Nobel Prize, because after the Nobel Prize, people came to know her so well that it was really very difficult to get much time with her.
Mm-hmm.
But before the Nobel Prize, Mother would come to the sisters and would kind of relax with us. I remember that she came in, she blessed us all, and we came in and had dinner together, and she was joking, she was telling all the stories of Calcutta, she was bringing a great deal of love, and I saw her also in the chapel before that, and then also at the prayer before the meal. The way she was focused, she was... You could just see that something very special was going on there. She was completely present in these moments of prayer.
So it's no surprise to you that so many people have been struck by something different about her.
Without a question, she was the most dedicated person I've ever met.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about how this life had so many difficulties. Mother Teresa got far less sleep than I did.
Mm-hmm.
You know, her responsibilities kept her up way past 10 o'clock, and still she was always the first one in the chapel at 4:40. She was very dedicated. She was very determined. I don't think that she was the kind of person, kind of universal mother figure as Westerners would normally understand that. I think Mother Teresa had much more of a tough love
mm-hmm.
than a kind of a tenderness about that. But she was very interested in each person who came to her. I saw her do things like, because of those 20 years that I was a nun, 15 of them were in Rome. And Mother Teresa would come, and she would often have appointments with people in the Vatican. And
you know,
I remember
Mary, let me jump in.
Yes?
I'm sorry, we have to take a break. So we're going to
sure.
stop here, and we'll finish the story in a moment. My guest is Mary Johnson. Her new memoir is called An Unquenchable Thirst, Following Mother Teresa in Search of Love, Service, and an Authentic Life. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer, teacher, and speaker Mary Johnson, who spent 20 years as Sister Donata in Mother Teresa's Order, the Missionaries of Charity. Her new book is called An Unquenchable Thirst, Following Mother Teresa in Search of Love, Service, and an Authentic Life. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Before the break, Mary, you were telling us that in the 15 years that you were working in and living in Rome and Mother Teresa was there, people would come to see her.
Yes, and that Mother often had appointments in the Vatican. And I was just beginning to tell the story of how one day she had an appointment with the Pope, and we were trying to get her into the car that would take her there. But there was a homeless fellow who used to come to see Mother Teresa whenever she was in Rome, and somehow he always knew when she was there. And he appeared, and we knew that if Mother went out the front door, that Paolo would stop her and talk to her, and she would be late to see the Pope. But Mother wouldn't allow us to take her out the back, and she went out the front, and she knew she had an appointment, and she spent her time there for 5-10 minutes talking with Paolo, and then finally got into the car. She was present to the people who were in front of her.
You make an interesting observation in the book, which is that she related to the least of her brethren, but as representatives of Jesus himself, rather than perhaps as individual human beings. Can you elaborate on that a little bit for us?
Yes, I think that was one of the things that I came to understand about the Missionaries of Charity that was a bit disturbing to me, was that very often, the focus was not so much on serving the needs of the person in front of you, but on realizing that Jesus was present in this person and Jesus was receiving the charity that you offered. When in the Gospel of Matthew we read that Jesus says, "I was hungry and you gave me to eat. I was thirsty and you gave me to drink." These were the words that motivated Mother Teresa. And among other words, but these were very important words to her. And that's all set in the Gospel of Matthew in the sense of the Last Judgment. And Jesus says, if you have fed the poor, if you've given drink to the thirsty, come into the kingdom of my Father. This is the place I've prepared for you. And gradually I came to see more and more how that motivation of doing things for Jesus could, on the one hand, mean that you treat the person in front of you with respect because it's Jesus, no matter who this person is, but that it also meant that that person ceased to be someone really present as they were and became more of a means to an end. I felt sometimes that the Missionaries of Charity as a group weren't focused enough really on dealing with the individuals, but just in getting the job done, in making sure that they had given so many people something to eat or whatever. I remember once when we were all having dinner together and Mother was there, and at each meal there would be one sister who was assigned to distribute the water. She'd go around with a big water pitcher and fill everyone's glass. And Mother stopped everyone's meal and said, "Do you know what Jesus will say? Jesus will say, 'You have given me so many glasses of water,' and Jesus will know the exact number." And these sorts of things rather gave me pause sometimes. Mm-hmm. But that's just one example among many.
You were really passionate about working with, as you mentioned, with poor people, but you loved working with children. And this was something that you didn't have much chance to do. Can you talk about that?
I loved working with children. I had the opportunity when I was in Rome as a novice, not yet having taken my vows, I began a program which helped gypsy children learn Italian. And I didn't know much Italian at the time. I would learn a few words, and then the next day I'd teach them to the children, and I taught them to write and to count and things like that. And that work was taken away from me fairly quickly, I think mostly because the sisters saw how much I enjoyed it. And it was more important for me to become humble, more important for me to become obedient than, you know, to do the work that I loved or to help these poor children. And the sisters who were assigned that work after me weren't really quite able to handle it, and that school for the gypsy children had to be closed down. When I was in the South Bronx, I worked a lot with the children. When I was in Washington, D.C., I worked a lot with the children. I really did enjoy that work. But all told, I think probably I worked with the children for about 4 years, and the rest of the time I was assigned work to help the sisters in the formation of the sisters who were preparing for their vows. That was something that I did for 6 years. I also was assigned office work of various sorts, but I didn't get much chance to work with the children.
I want to talk a little bit about compassion, because this order in particular is known for service to people who are at the very lowest echelons of society.
Absolutely.
It sounds as if many times within the convent itself, the compassion sort of stopped when the front door closed.
Things got tricky there, you know. It's always sort of easier to be nice to the people outside, you know, than the people who you're living with every day sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I think part of the problem also is that when you're giving of yourself so completely all the time and have no way to restore your strength, when you don't have the time to step back, especially, you know, you don't have the time for intimate relationships with other people, you can become very nervous. You can become very easily angered. And the other thing that fits into this equation is the fact that we were aiming very high,
mm-hmm.
that we were meant to live lives, literally, we were told, of perfection. Mm-hmm. And one is forever falling short of that goal. It's humanly not attainable.
So you fail a little bit every day.
You fail a little bit every day. Mm-hmm. It becomes very frustrating. And a person, the superior of the house, who is in charge of trying to make sure that the sisters reach this goal of perfection, sometimes seemed to have the impression that the best way to remind sisters that they were to behave well was by telling them how badly they were behaving.
Mm-hmm.
Which didn't always work too well, perhaps often, you know, perhaps it was so sometimes at least done with good intentions and sometimes out of nervousness or anger.
I want to talk about loneliness and the extent to which you think that that played into to what turned out to be physical sexual relationships that you had with other sisters. Can you tell us, one was rather brief and the other one was a little bit more complicated, but can you tell us a little bit about those?
Yes, I did feel lonely, as you mentioned. It was a life in which we were not to get close to other people. And then all of a sudden, there was a sister in my life who decided she was not going to let that get in the way and that she wanted to get close to me. And it was kind of like a magic word to hear her say one day, "I love you." No one mm-hmm. had said those words to me before. And it was very confusing for me in many ways because I knew that this was a violation of my vow of chastity. I had given this gift of myself to God. I didn't want to take it back. And at the same time, what she was offering me felt so right somehow. It felt like, well, aren't we supposed to be treating each other well? Aren't we supposed to express love for one another in various ways? It became a very confusing time for me, and eventually the relationship with this particular sister, this longer relationship that you mentioned, became extremely complicated, and it became evident that she was very manipulative and had a big problem. And a good portion of the book is related to detailing how that all played out and the effects it had on me.
Do you think this would have been less of a temptation for you had you had some confidants and some sort of, and I'm going to put this in air quotes because we can define this word in many ways, but some normal friendships in your life?
I do, actually. I do. I think, you know, I had been longing for normal, regular relationships. I mean, just to be able to speak freely with someone about the things, the good things and the difficult things. To be able to share with someone what you're feeling. I think that would have been a very big help for everyone. And as I slowly had more authority within the group, as I was given different positions of responsibility, I tried to foster more those sorts of relationships with the sisters in the community, tried to find ways of helping everyone to be at least a little bit more open and more relaxed.
One thing that you discovered over time, and as you got to know Mother Teresa better, and particularly her writings, because you had a lot to do with editing the things that she had written, you discovered that she was constantly admonishing the, mothers superior of individual convents to be very kind to the people they supervised, and somehow that message was not filtering through. And you'd gotten the impression that Mother Teresa had wanted every convent ruled with an iron hand.
I remember very clearly. I was given mothers' letters to the superiors to type and to make into a booklet. And these were letters that I hadn't even known existed. Only superiors ever saw them, and I was not yet a superior at that point. But I was given the copies of these letters and asked to type them out. And as I did so, I saw that Mother Teresa was constantly telling the superiors, please be kind to your sisters. Treat them with love. This community is your family. Be like mothers to them. And it was a very encouraging thing for me in one sense, because I could think to myself, oh, well, this is good. We're not really supposed to be harsh like this. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, I could feel the pain that Mother Teresa experienced when she wrote these things, that it really pained her to know that we weren't always treating each other with respect.
I think, Mary, for me, reading the book, one of the most heartbreaking moments is when Mother Teresa is quite elderly and infirm, and it's clear she's ready to sort of retire and pass the leadership of the organization on, and she's sort of brought back into it, and essentially you ask her, well, why don't you just quit? And she says, I can't. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Mother Teresa had called a special election. The Missionaries of Charity every 6 years hold an election for the Superior General, which is the position that Mother Teresa had held from the beginning, since she was the one who founded the group. And she had previously asked us to elect someone else. She was getting old. She was getting tired. She had had several bouts of illness, and she had this heart condition with which she was struggling. Rather than wait for the next regular six-year cycle, Mother Teresa called for a special election. She said, I really can't do this anymore. You need to elect someone else. But the sisters elected Mother again. Hmm. And she came to Rome a few days after that election. And I'll never forget, we were all sitting at the table, and she was looking very glum, which was really not her normal way of looking, and very sad. And we're trying to find things to say. And I told Mother, I got a letter from my grandfather the other day. He's 10 years older than you are. And he told me that I should tell you that you need to step back a little bit, that you need to relax a little bit, take some rest. And Mother looked at me with these piercing eyes, and she said, I can't. It is God's will. Because she always felt that these elections were representations of God's will. And it was a very, very, very painful thing for me to hear Mother that way, and to see how tired she was, and to know that she was going to be doing this job for another 6 years.
It wasn't until after her death that the broader world knew about the sort of crises of faith that she endured for years upon years. Was this something that you had been aware of during her life?
Because I had studied Mother Teresa's writing so closely, I had some inkling that something was going on, and I had spoken with some of the priests who were close to her. And, of course, they would never betray any confidence that she had given them. But when I would express my wonderings, they would rather sort of nod and would not dispute things. I did have an inkling. And Mother Teresa was a person who, as I've said, was just so dedicated and had decided so firmly to believe. And this act of deciding that she was going to believe was what she clung to when she did not feel God's presence, when she questioned sometimes, is there a God? But these were things that were very quiet, just that she kept hidden. She always kept her inner life very close.
She as far as you could tell, became sort of invested in the idea that she would be canonized. Can you talk about that?
Well, in every missionary of Charity House, in the refectory, the room in which we took our meals, there is a crucifix, a picture of Mary, a picture of the Sacred Heart of Jesus, and a picture of Mother Teresa. And underneath that picture of Mother Teresa, there's a little homemade plaque which has words from Mother Teresa, a direct quote where she says, "I will give saints to Mother Church." And Mother Teresa used to often repeat that to us, that she had made the promise to Jesus that she would give saints to Mother Church and that she expected us all to be saints. And it was very clear that she was expecting herself to be a saint. And for a very long time, I thought that that just meant that we were to live very holy lives, that we were to be saints with small s's, not capital S's.
Mm-hmm.
But gradually I came to see that for Mother Teresa, perhaps there was something more working there. And I remember when she had been for several meetings, the bishops had a synod in Rome that Mother was invited to attend, and she attended it, and she was in Rome for several weeks at a time then. And one day we were having tea with her, and Mother told us, she said, "You must all hurry up and die." And we just kind of looked at Mother. What on earth is Mother saying? "You must hurry up and die." And she said, "The Holy Father, this Holy Father, he's canonizing everyone." And, you know, it definitely made us laugh, but I could see in the way she said it that there was more to it than that for her.
My guest this hour is writer, teacher, and speaker Mary Johnson, who spent 20 years as Sister Donata in Mother Teresa's Order, the Missionaries of Charity. We're talking this hour about her memoir, An Unquenchable Thirst, Following Mother Teresa in Search of Love, Service, and an Authentic Life. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is writer Mary Johnson, who spent 20 years as a sister in the Missionaries of Charity Order. Her new book is called An Unquenchable Thirst, Following Mother Teresa in Search of Love, Service, and an Authentic Life. Mary, can you compare the certainty with which you decided you needed to leave the order with the certainty you felt when you decided to join the order?
Well, I was 20 years older when I decided to leave, and it was a much, much more measured decision. When I decided to join, as I've said before, it was just that fire burning in my heart, this conviction that of a 19-year-old that I was doing the right thing, that I was just really going to go out there and do what I needed to do. And then in 20 years, so many different things happened, and as a missionary of charity, you're told over and over again, basically, that the worst thing you could do is to leave because God has called you here. God has given you this vocation. And so leaving was very difficult. I thought about it for a long time. I didn't take the decision lightly. At a certain point, I told myself, okay, so this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to spend an entire year doing everything that is exactly expected of me. I'm going to make sure I observe all of my vows really rigorously. I'm going to do whatever my superiors ask of me. I'm going to try my best to see if I can, while I'm obeying all those rules, still be myself. Because by this time I realized that forcing myself into a mold where I couldn't be myself, couldn't really be something good for me, couldn't be something that God wanted. I kept hearing these words of Jesus in my mind over and over again. I came that you may have life and have it to the full. And I felt like, I'm not getting the fullness of life thing here. What's going on? So I did spend that year really praying and trying my best. And at the end of the year, I knew that I had to leave, but it wasn't a fire burning in my heart. There was a sadness there. It was very difficult. And at the same time, that decision brought me peace. Hmm. And it was a much more mature decision than the decision to enter the convent had been, because I was a more mature person by then.
It sounds a little bit like, you know, and I know that you know, sisters are told they are the brides of Christ. Mm-hmm. It sounds a little bit like the end of a long marriage.
Yes. I think it could easily be compared to a divorce. And I think, you know, the difficulties that come with that, and trying to find yourself again afterwards, and the pain that comes of having gone through so many beautiful things, so many difficult things, but just 20 years of life with a very particular group, with a very particular commitment, is very similar to a long marriage.
Did you have that sense of, like, Jesus, I gave you the best 20 years of my life at the end of this?
Not immediately. I think it was kind of like afterwards, after I'd been out for a while, and mm-hmm. began to realize how much I had missed, how many things had happened. All my sisters had gotten married while I was away, and I hadn't, you know, been able to attend their weddings. My niece and nephews were born, and I had missed all sorts of opportunities to read, to educate myself. And I realized at a certain point that wasn't coming back. And there was a time where I was filled with regrets for a while, and slowly I had to let those go as I realized that, well, I really couldn't have lived my life in another way. I had to go when I went. I probably would never have forgiven myself if I hadn't followed that great passion that I had when I was 19. And I had an experience that was extraordinary and that was part of my path.
Do you think you would still believe in God today if you hadn't become a nun?
I don't know. It's an interesting question. It's really hard to know. We don't know what we would do given any different circumstance in our lives. Don't know.
So it's been several years, I guess 14 years since you left the order. How long did it take for you to get comfortable telling this part of your life story to the people that you became friends with?
Well, I found that, you know, when I would tell people in the beginning, when I first met them, that, you know, I had been with Mother Teresa of Calcutta, that I was a nun for 20 years, that they started looking at me kind of strange. And then afterwards, it was kind of like the only thing they wanted to talk about. So I started, you know, trying to make friendships where I didn't talk too much about that right in the beginning, because mm-hmm. I wanted to go into new parts of my life. So there was that part of it to get used to. But then actually telling all the details of what's in my book was a very long process, and something, the book took me 10 years to write. It took me quite a while to decide whether I was actually going to tell this story, even as I was writing it, to wonder whether or not I should publish it. It's not easy to make yourself really, you know, that open and that vulnerable on the page. I try to bring the reader in very close to my experience, so that people who are reading the book can kind of go through and feel what I felt as I went along. And it's difficult to open yourself on the page that way.
Do you do all kinds of writing now?
The memoir took a big chunk of writing time out. I've written some book reviews. I've done some poetry. I've dabbled a little bit in fiction. I haven't published any fiction. I do some more essay type writing as well.
Well, you spent so many years of your life, and I know it's been years since that time, but not really being encouraged to express yourself, that I think it's fascinating that writing is sort of your profession now.
Writing is my profession, and writing had always been important to me. When I was in high school, I edited the school newspaper. I worked on the school's literary magazine. I'd always been writing. There's a picture on my desk that I see right in front of me right now, actually. I'm in the first grade, I think, and my sister is also in the picture. We're standing on either side of a large easel. And Kathy's drawing these beautiful pictures, and I'm on my side, and I'm writing a story on this big sheet of paper. I think I've always been a person who's been kind of fascinated with stories. And I remember, you know, not being able to write when I was a sister, though I did get opportunity when I was studying Mother Teresa's work to do a little bit of writing then. But for so many years, I wasn't allowed to write at all. I remember at a certain point, I just had this longing. I just wanted to write a poem. I really just wanted to get it out there. And I knew that I couldn't. And I told myself, I have to make my life into my poem. Hmm. And so it was a process of kind of pouring everything I had into that life and just trying to make sure that it expressed what I felt inside.
Are there ways in which you still feel very Catholic, even without faith?
I have an affinity towards things Catholic, in the sense, like if I go into a Catholic church, there's part of me that still feels immediately at home, and there's another part that knows I don't quite fit anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly have a great number of friends who are Catholic. Many members of my family are Catholic. And I definitely can always, you know, relate to people on that level. I think, you know, when you've given yourself to an institution, when you've grown up within a faith community, somehow you always carry part of that with you.
One thing I really liked about your book is the places, Mary, in which you talk about Mother Teresa are very nuanced, and she's very human. And it seems like since her death, the literature has gone two ways. There's the sort of Christopher Hitchens, you know, Mother Teresa was entirely bad. And then there are the, you know, even written by secular people, there are accounts of her life that are only about her goodness and her kindness.
Right.
Do you think we do ourselves a disservice by not trying to fully understand who she was as a human being?
Absolutely, I do. And that was one of the things that convinced me that writing the book would probably be a good thing. Just for the sake of trying to present Mother Teresa as a more three-dimensional person, because she was. She was a human being, as we all are. She was an extraordinary human being.
Mm-hmm.
But she was a human being. She had her moments of doubt. She had her moments of fear, of discouragement, of sadness. She had her moments of joy. Why shouldn't a person be presented in all their three-dimensionalness? I do understand that, you know, as human beings, we want there to be someone who is really showing us the way, someone that we can think, at least this person has absolutely no flaws.
Yeah.
But I think we do ourselves a disservice at the same time that we do that, because there really aren't any people like that.
You have, by the way, a really cute story in the book about, you mentioned earlier that Mother Teresa got even less sleep than you, even when she was quite old. And you were traveling with her at one point, and she still wanted to wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning or something. Could you tell us that story?
We were traveling together to Sweden, and it was just Mother and I. And in this particular town, there was not a convent, and so they had put us up in the home of a Lutheran pastor, and people were very kind to us, and they gave us a little room there, and there was a little clock, and we got in very late. We had flown in, and then we'd driven for several hours, and it was past midnight, and I asked Mother, you know, what time do we need to get up? What should I set the clock for? And she's trying to figure it out, and we need to pray, and we need to do this, and we have to make the beds before we leave. And, you know, she gave me a certain time that I needed to set the clock for, but I just couldn't do that. It was like 3 or 4 hours from, you know, we would have gotten almost no sleep. And I set the alarm clock a little later, and Mother noticed when we got up in the morning, and there was a little moment of tension there for a moment, but Mother was really very elderly and tired at that point, and still she wanted to keep on going, keep on giving, keep on with all the schedule and all the prayers. Oh, it's really extraordinary.
Do you think there was any part of her that wished somebody would give her permission to relax a little bit?
I do. I think that was part of the stress that she felt when she had asked the sisters to elect someone else and they re-elected her, and she had that moment of disappointment, that moment of inner struggle that was evident in that story we talked about earlier. I think, you know, she had asked us to let her step down, and then for various reasons the sisters re-elected her.
So you don't write much here about the subsequent chapter of your life when you re-engaged with the world. Is that something that you've thought about documenting later on?
I think it'll probably be the subject of a second book. People are very interested in that, you know, how do you go from such an existence into a new life, and what's that transition like? Many people have expressed interest in that story. It's likely I'll write about that. This book already was, you know, very big just with these 20 years. It's a big book. I've been told that it moves quickly, but I certainly couldn't include that next part of my life in this book as well. But it is something that I actually am writing about in various ways now.
And so when you left, you had lived on your own for a while, and you're married now, and you things are going well for you?
Yes, things are going very well. I'm very happy, and the book is actually going to be out on bookshelves tomorrow, so it's kind of a milestone for me. And I work also very much with an organization that helps women writers called A Room of Our Own Foundation, and I found a real community among these women as well. Very happy now. In fact, when I saw my father recently, who is a very devout Catholic, he told me something very interesting. He said, "Well, all I have to do is look at you and see how happy you are now to know that you made the right decision when you left." Hmm. And that was the kind of thing he had never said to me before.
Were you afraid that your parents wouldn't? I mean, initially they didn't understand your decision to join, but then at some point were you afraid they would be disappointed in you?
I knew that my parents would always somehow stand by my side. My parents have been very generous with all of their children and the various choices, mistakes, and triumphs of our lives. I have really wonderful parents in that respect. And they, when I left the sisters, I did sense a certain sort of disappointment, a certain sort of wondering, but they never voiced that in any way. They never... you know, and over the years, I think they've really come to understand and to be at peace with all of that.
Oh, Mary Johnson, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Chris.
The new memoir by Mary Johnson is called An Unquenchable Thirst, Following Mother Teresa in Search of Love, Service, and an Authentic Life. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.